some Hoosier history.
There's more online at HoosierHistoryLive.org. Molly Head, producer. Mick Armbruster, associate producer. Weekly show podcast at HoosierHistoryLive.org and on our weekly newsletter. Thanks to Richard Sullivan, M. Frazier, and 88.7 The Diamond.
This is Rockin' Dave, inviting you to join me every Sunday at midnight for Rockin' Dave's Roots Roundup, an hour of the best rockabilly, jump blues, and western swing. That's Rockin' Dave's Roots Roundup, every Sunday at midnight on WICR The Diamond. Get your roots on!
The Score is a weekly celebration of the music that makes good movies great. Host Edmund Stone covers all the bases with such topics as playing politics, summer blockbusters, The Orchestrator, Stranded, and features on individual composers for the cinema. It's a cultural trip through everyone's most common musical experience. That's The Score with Edmund Stone, Saturday mornings at 10 on WICR, a different kind of public radio.
Broadcasting from the University of Indianapolis, this is 88.7 The Diamond, WICR-FM and HD1, Indianapolis.
The opinions expressed on the following program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WICR management or ownership.
It's time for She Says Art and He Says Science, your weekly hour of edutainment as you learn about the creative interaction between artists and scientists with your host Jill Dittmeyer, a journalist and arts enthusiast, and Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. The call-in phone number is 317-788-3314. Now it's time for She Says Art and He Says Science.
I'm Mark Kiesling, founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we use art to teach science. Welcome to She Says Art and He Says Science. And usually I have my co-host, Jill Dittmeyer, here saying that she says the art part, but she might check in with us a little bit later by phone. In our studio with me are two guests. I have scientist Bill Sullivan. Welcome, Bill.
Hello.
And artist Bennett Ayers. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
And we're going to talk about, oh my gosh, I love this, spooky science, my favorite holiday of the year, Halloween. You're invited to join our conversation by calling in our next segment. You can call us at 317-788-3314. Bill, you work in Showalter, professor of pharmacology and toxicology and microbiology and immunology at Indiana University School of Medicine. A mouthful.
Yeah, it sure is, but you got it right.
I got it right, yay. And Ben, you're a local writer and director and also one of the founders of Timepiece Theater Company, which we'll get into here in a little bit too.
Yes, yeah. I started that with a co-founder, Jim Tillett, who's a great actor and director here in town as well.
How cool. So that'll be really, really great to look at both of those. Well, Bill, we just wanted to start out with really spooky stuff. And so I know that you've been involved in looking at something that affects cats in a really spooky way, and I can't think of anything more Halloween and spooky than cats. You want to talk a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, sure. So my research centers on this parasite called Toxoplasma gondii. And for those of you who haven't heard of it, it is a single-celled parasite that primarily infects cats as the definitive host. For reasons we don't understand, cats are the only organism where the parasite can complete the sexual stage of its life cycle. So it really wants to be in the cat. But Toxoplasma is an astonishing generalist and can get into any vertebrate host, including humans. So the CDC estimates that about 25% of Americans have become infected with this parasite, and it's a permanent infection.
Wow. And so what behaviors does a cat manifest?
It's a very stealthy parasite in the cat. You won't know that your cat is sick. But what the cat will do during about 1 to 2 weeks after it's infected is spew these oocysts, these parasite eggs, if you will, out into the environment. So it gets in the litter box, the sandbox, people's yards, and it fully infiltrates the food and water chain. And that's why it's so easy to contract.
Wow. So there's two levels of spookiness here. We've got a spooky virus at one level, and then we have something that is affecting a behavior, right? The behavior of the animal.
Yes, you're right. So you might be wondering, if 25% of people are infected with this, why have I never really heard of this this parasite before?
Right.
So like I said, it won't do much in the cat, but if it gets into a mouse or a rat, normally those organisms scurry away when they smell a cat. It's a basic instinct. They run away.
Wow.
But when they're infected with toxoplasma, they lose their ability to be afraid of cats. They're no longer frightful of them. They just are easy prey.
And oh, my goodness.
That's what's so spooky about it, right?
Yeah.
The parasite is basically this exquisite neurosurgeon that somehow goes to the brain of these rodents and rewires it in a way that the basic instinct to avoid cats is erased.
That's really amazing. So speaking of bugs, you, Ben, have been able to portray a character, a historic character, kind of a ghost of a character. Mm-hmm. And you want to talk a little bit about Thomas Say?
Yes. So the first character that the Timepiece Theater Company has rolled out is Thomas Say. Pretty fascinating guy. He was, at the end of his life, he was a Hoosier, lived in New Harmony, Indiana, but grew up in Philadelphia and tried in his early adulthood, tried to be an apothecary or a pharmacist, and that business failed horribly, went bankrupt, and then pursued his passion, which was zoology, specifically entomology. And so he, just himself in his life, studied and described and named about 1,500 different insects.
Wow.
Some pollinators, some parasites on that topic. But yeah, pretty remarkable guy. And I think, you know, he's a good person to learn about, but especially this time of year, it's nice to think about that. I think he would be an exceptional candidate for ghosthood, because he died fairly young. His life was cut short, and in a pretty nasty way. He had already suffered from gallstones, but then also got a nasty bout of typhoid fever and dysentery.
Oh, my
So goodness. I think he probably would have some unfinished business here on Earth. I don't think he'd be a ghost that would disturb you too much. You might find that your magnifying glasses have been moved around, and
yeah.
Maybe your pens are out of ink because he's been scribbling notes. But, yeah, I think he would have done a lot more if he'd had more time. He died at 47.
Wow. Very young age, actually. You know, one of the interesting things that we try to talk about a lot on this show is that the intersection between the art form and science form, and we haven't had the art form of theater on yet. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of our first example of that.
Yeah.
So how do you go about researching and making sure you're accurate in portraying and yet getting a sense of also bringing a lot to live, which is a little bit of fiction in it at the same time, so
yeah.
You're historically accurate in that. Can you talk about how you develop a character?
Absolutely. So, I mean, specifically for Thomas Say, you know, looking at biographies of him, but also there was a journal on an expedition that he was part of in 1819 where they basically, United States Army followed the path of Lewis and Clark all the way to the Rocky Mountains for their own military purposes. But along with them came painters, botanists, geologists, and a zoologist, Thomas Say, to kind of, you know, see what sort of critters and life they could find along the way. So there's a journal for that. So you want to learn as much information about these historical characters as you can to be accurate. But at the same time, you know, in theater, we don't necessarily want to be historians. But we can use story, and we can use a personal story about someone who was alive to open the door so that people then can kind of take the next step into history or science and then talk to the experts in those fields. So we can kind of use story to make it easier for people to jump in and learn a little bit more about history. That's really our goal.
Well, I really love that. Bill, do you feel that good communicators in science use the art of story?
We try to encourage that every day. I run a research communications class, and that's one of the things we try to impart, especially into the younger trainees. And it's a really critical skill, and some scientists do it better than others.
Right.
But there's a large portion of them that aren't even aware that human beings evolved telling stories around campfires for tens of thousands of years. That's what gets us excited. That's what keeps us interested. Mm-hmm. And that's what's going to help people remember your material if you can frame it in the in like a mystery. You know, every scientist mm-hmm. works on an intriguing question of some kind, pose that question, and then tell people in an entertaining way how you got the answer.
Yeah. And, you know, we're all kind of on the same trip. You know, nobody's going to live forever. But it's funny to think about, you know, the people who have passed on that we remember, generally, when they were alive, they either lived or thought, you know, outside of their own time. And so, again, you know, it's important, you know, with theater and with these stories that we tell to help people learn. It's not just the stuff they did, but, you know, what they were up against and how they were able to stay the course despite those challenges. And also, you know, what toll that took on them, because a lot of them didn't get out of it very well, but they did make a huge difference. And that's why we remember them 50 or 100 or 200 years after they're gone.
Yeah, and that's really interesting because our theme is spooky science, but there must be something in that storytelling as to why we really like this idea of the fantasy and this, you know, thinking about vampires and other mm-hmm. creatures. The art of the story sometimes obviously gets blown beyond the science that was there, but I would think that there's something to that about stories being kind of interesting to our psyche in some way.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of appeal there. And I think virtually everyone loves a good mystery. And at the end of the day, that's what science is all about. No matter how small your question seems to be, at the core of it, there's a mystery that needs to be solved. And I believe that strikes a passion within us all.
That's really great.
Yeah, and also I think the possibilities of what, you know, people are attracted to science and science fiction because it's a scientific reality we don't know, but it could be one that we could know sometime. You know, for example, I think, you know, nobody can deny that our cell phones are based on what we watched in Star Trek. And so that was just a fun fantasy that then became a reality. It's cool to think about how it, you know, these things that seem so strange in fiction can become just, you know, our everyday lives.
Yeah, we have a kind of a phrase sometimes that we think about in science education and, you know, educating students in general. But if you kind of want it to figure out what the future is, you have to invent it. Mm-hmm. And in a way, what you're talking about is humans have this unique ability to get an idea, and it might be a fantastical idea at the time, but then that may actually influence their actual research later. Bill, do you have examples of where something's influenced?
Well, yeah, I would say, first, what we're speaking about is basically all these campfire chats firing the imagination, you know, in a very similar way. But what really, I think, separates the scientist is that when the germ of that idea settles in, then they go out and explore it, or they have some sort of passion to go out there and investigate the mystery. So I think a lot of our what we call gaps in our knowledge, we like to plug those up because the brain is very uncomfortable with uncertainty. It likes a closed story, and the brain has a lot of things to worry about, most importantly, what's for lunch or something like that. So we can't be preoccupied with these holes in our knowledge. So we use duct tape and all these other little things to just plug that hole up so we can worry about it at some other time. And when we can't find a natural explanation for something, this is when we plug it up with something supernatural. Can't prove it, but you can't disprove it. Can't say you're wrong, can't say you're right. So it's just kind of in a holding pattern. But a scientist will look at that and say, well, it's intriguing. It's an interesting idea. Let's go out and test it.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I love it when I go to my doctor. I'm married to a veterinarian. And when I propose something, sometimes out of my more art side or creative side, I'll get a thing that, well, let's go see.
There you go.
You know, and I'm tapping into the science side of that. And I think that's really interesting. Although the really good doctors, the really good scientists, the really good communicators in theater are the ones who can tell a story really well. Because they're able to then somehow connect us, right, back into something that, again, our attention can hold on to.
That's right.
Wow. That's amazing. When you're out doing your development of characters, you're thinking about a whole lot of things. One is the accuracy in the history. But I want to still explore a little more. I asked you kind of briefly about it. But How do you blend when you don't know something? How do you create that?
That's a good question, and that I think is a good part of storytelling. Where when and how is it appropriate to fill in those gaps with what we don't know, with what we can invent?
Yeah.
What might have been discussed between two scientists in a room at one point. We take what we know about the two people, where we think they stood, what their personality might have been, and then you can, based off of that, then you can fill in the rest with your imagination, and depend on the imagination of your audience, which is bigger than a lot of people think. When I'm out and about, doing these pop-up performances, people a lot of times, again, if you can begin the story well, then they will take it and run because their imagination is hungry too. Even if they thought that they were just out to, buy bread or apples or something else at a farmer's market, or just kind of going on their daily lives.
Wow. So kind of the art form here too is also being able to put fiction in, but in an appropriate way that doesn't take somebody down a false path.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow. That really is. I know scientists usually have things, but I would think when you work on models or you try to create some sort of a vision for what you're looking at, you must also be in the imagination fantasy a little bit. I think one of the things we've found is a lot of people don't think scientists are ever creative or imaginative, and yet I think that they're ever highly both of those. What do you feel about that?
Well, I think on the side of that argument, I clearly side with you. It takes extraordinary imagination and creativity in order to come up with novel ideas. And, just take a look at Louis Pasteur, the father of microbiology. In the mid-1800s, that's when he came up with his germ theory of disease. Prior to that theory, everyone thought that life would just spontaneously emerge from other things. So, for example, the maggots that emerge from rotted meat were just transformed meat that turned into maggots. No one really thought flies were coming down and laying eggs there. Same thing, like if you got mold on your bread or your wine spoiled, they just thought that there was a spontaneous generation of life, a transformation of material from non-living to living. Louis Pasteur abolished that idea when he did his famous experiment just by letting a culture media sit out in the air, and then it would obviously get contaminated with microbes that fell in. And then he bent the neck of that flask so that the air microbes couldn't hit the liquid. It never got contaminated. It stays sterile forever. And this is where we get pasteurization, because he extended that idea to show that heating liquid killed the microbes inside. So this was a huge transformation in our way of thinking. And it took a lot of creativity to imagine that there's invisible creatures flying through the air, contaminating our food and water. But if we heat it up, we can kill them. And no one bought that idea, so he had to prove it by experimentation.
That in and of itself it's very exciting, but it's also spooky that you can get locked in a kind of a belief system that is the made-up belief system because you don't have anything else to go on. And that can prohibit you or a lot of people from thinking.
Sure, and we still have examples of where that's true today.
Wow, and some of those might be like global climate change?
Well, yeah, that's one of them that comes to mind.
Yeah.
For some reason, people think thermometers lie.
Our data doesn't, yeah.
But it's a hard idea to swallow if you are not scientifically literate, because you can't see it happening on a day-to-day basis. You have to use your imagination to extrapolate what the data means and what the future forecasts really indicate.
Go ahead.
Oh, and I think it takes a, like Bill was saying, a tremendous amount of imagination, but also, trust in just going out and observing without a preconceived notion. And, Thomas Say in one of his books, and this was in the 1830s, it said, read nature. Nature is a friend to truth. And that was really before its time. The idea that, yes, the truth of who we are can be found in nature, but also where we're going. If you don't read nature, you can be taken by surprise because it's all there.
Oh, I love that. That's a great quote.
I love that. That's great. Yeah. So we're going to take a little break here in a minute. When we return, we're going to talk more with Bill Sullivan and more with Bennett Ayers. And hopefully we're going to explore a little bit of some monster origins when we get back. If you want to call in after the break, it'll be 317-788-3314.
When you listen to Folk Alley, you experience a tradition that's been handed down for hundreds of years. I'm Elena C., and Folk Alley is a link in the chain that includes the ancient child ballads and the latest releases from your favorite singer-songwriters. Bluegrass, Celtic, Americana blues, and much more. It's all part of the Folk Alley mix. You'll also meet the performers and hear exclusive recordings, so I hope you'll join me each week on Folk Alley.
Join us for Folk Alley, Sunday nights at 9.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
Hello again, I'm Joe Girard, your host for Inside Great American Music. And as you know by now, we're here every Sunday at 5 p.m. Eastern right here on 88.7 The Diamond WICR. Our show continues to follow the Great American Songbook, and this week it's part two of Judy Garland at Carnegie Hall. Join us this Sunday at 5 p.m. Eastern right here on 88.7 The Diamond WICR.
Listen every weekday at noon for Smooth Jazz with Doug Housemeyer, where you can find out what's happening in the arts community from the people in the arts community. You'll get smooth jazz legends like Pat Metheny, Dave Cause, and Boney James. Smooth Jazz with Doug Housemeyer on 88.7 The Diamond.
I'm Mark Kiesling, and you're listening to She Says Art and He Says Science. And today we're talking some spooky science with our guest, Bill Sullivan, and Bennett Ayers. If you have a question, please call in during this segment at 317-788-3314. When we left, I wanted us to talk about vampires and spooky myths and where they come from. And I also want us to talk a little bit about something that I remember as a child, which was the House of Blue Lights in Indianapolis. And I know you've developed a character for that. Can you talk a little bit about the House of Blue Lights and what you developed as a play?
So a couple years ago, I got together with the really great artists at No Exit Performance, and they're known for doing a lot of great stuff, both that's visually stimulating and different, but also they like to do plays and performances in just really odd places around town. And they wanted to do a show at one of the buildings out by the old Central State Psychiatric Hospital over there on the west side. And they wanted it to be about a guy named Skiles Test. And I'm not from Indianapolis, so I never knew the story about this guy. So I started looking into it. And they, you know, what they knew, and I'd be interested to see what your experience was with it, but that, you know, he was a very wealthy person, had a lot of property, had a real fascination with lights, and in particular blue lights that you could see from a great distance. And also, that a lot of stories began circulating about what he was doing there. And I think people thought that one of his former wives, that her body was in a glass case, and that he had all these coffins, and so then it began to snowball. And but nobody really knew exactly what it was. And so then they, you know, we began talking, and then I thought, well, again, if all we know is, you know, we know factual data on this guy and who he was and where he lived, and we know about his property a little bit and the things he owned, but other than that, we don't know what was going on there. And I thought, well, what if we could have fun with the idea that his fascination with lights on his property was because he was manipulating light to be able to open a time portal. And and they thought, are you serious? And I said, yeah, why not? And so I wrote a script, and it was a pretty cool thing. But that's kind of what I meant when we were talking before, where you take as much factual data as you can, and then with the parts that are fuzzy, you can have a lot of fun if you can fairly make something up and let it fit into the real history. And that's where you can really do some cool stuff with science fiction and historical fiction as well, and theater and all of that.
So that's really great. That leads into segue to Bill. Bill, so people must have some desire to fill in the gaps.
Yes, that's right. Our mind wants to do that.
Right. And so how have we filled in the gaps with monster stories?
Well, there's we could sit here and talk all day about those sorts of things, but we will focus on vampires since you brought it up earlier. So there are a number of different conditions that could have explained or fueled the legend of vampires. So this goes back to the 1600s. It's a Slavic term for bloodsucker, and it originated largely when people realized that blood was equated to life. Without blood, you lose your life. So it goes to follow that people who are undead require blood in order to maintain their undeadness. Okay, so they needed to suck
their undead
on
life.
Their undead life. They needed to suck on the living, extract their blood in order to continue existence. So there was a researcher not long ago named Juan Gomez Alonso who drew four important parallels between vampirism and the rabies virus.
Oh, my goodness.
I think everyone's pretty familiar with rabies and its symptoms, even though it's not very common today. Back in the 1600s, it was very common and very terrifying to see. So the four parallels, just real quick, the first one was biting. So rabies virus is transmitted through biting, and vampirism can be transmitted through biting as well. Then there's hydrophobia. This is a fear of water. Vampires are afraid of holy water in particular. But rabies victims are deadly afraid of water because they can't swallow anymore. The rabies virus paralyzes the throat muscles, and that's why you see them foaming at the mouth. And this is all part of rabies' ability to transmit from one person to the next. There's also heightened sexual appetites in both people with rabies and in vampire folklore. And then finally, there's the connection to bats. Bats transmit rabies, and vampires can morph into bats.
So that's how we got this connection between, and there are some bats, right, that correct, they do actually not drink blood, but they actually will feed on some our host or not?
Absolutely, and they can transmit a number of viruses, rabies included.
Okay, so much like a mosquito, but in a bigger scale.
A much bigger scale, right.
But yeah, that's really interesting, and I think we forget that rabies stays in the pretty much in the mammal family. And then we forget that bats are mammals.
Right. And what we have to keep in mind, the important fact is these legends originated in a time where we knew nothing about germs, genetics, or brain psychology. And that's hard for us to do. We take all those things for granted. So you really got to use your imagination to put yourself in the mindset of someone who did not have access to that information.
Wow. And I think, and Bill, you could probably speak more to this on, you know, how the brain functions, but I think it's fascinating how people, you know, going centuries and centuries back have been fascinated with stories about them being hunted. Like the only thing scarier than a person being hunted is a person being hunted by a thing that looks like a person. And that's why I think vampires and zombies are so, it's a premise that doesn't seem to get old because it's so terrifying but fascinating. And I don't know if that's part of our evolution and the way our brain functions, but we can't seem to get tired of those cool
stories. Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think, and I don't know if that's something that's species related, but I think we as humans, because we can express what we're feeling through our language, we may in fact be most afraid of another human, especially one that might not be alive, mm-hmm. you know, that appears to be alive and isn't alive. And we always hear stories of people coming back from the dead. What do you think is happening in those stories?
I'll field that one if
you'll
you want.
That one, yeah.
There again, there's a number of explanations for this. So, and some of it goes back to vampire folklore. But then again, there's also like the zombie legends from Haitian voodoo culture in which people were believed to be dead when they were actually just in a catatonic state because of a paralytic zombie dust, right? But sticking with vampires, you have to ask the question, why was there any belief that someone could come back from the dead, okay? And there were some lines of evidence that might have been suggestive of this. So back then, especially in amongst the common people, graves were shallow. And if people were buried in the cold years, it was not uncommon for people to be buried alive. They didn't have sophisticated medical equipment to confirm that someone had passed away. So it was a guess. And if someone was just in a deep sleep or unconscious or a comatose, they could really be buried alive. This was not terribly uncommon. Grave robbing was also common at the time. So you had some grave robber digging around trying to find some jewelry or clothing, and they found a person was not actually dead.
He's not actually dead. Well, how creepy is that?
They were dead, you know? So yeah, that can end your career as a grave robber, I would imagine.
I would think so. You're trying to, you know, get a piece of jewelry off somebody, and all of a sudden they go, excuse me.
But if I can, there's even more morbid fact associated with this. And it relates back to why we think impaling a vampire through the chest might kill it. So when people back then in the 1600s were suspecting that people were rising from the dead and feeding on the living, they would dig people up sometimes. And especially in these shallow graves in the winter, the body decays rather slowly. And the first thing that happens is the top layer of skin falls off. But what lies beneath is a pretty pink, newish-looking skin. Hair and nails continued to look like they were growing, but that was an illusion because skin was just receding. But you put all these things together, and it plants this seed. It fuels the imagination that this person is really, you know, walking around and still feeding off the living. The other thing that happens is that the bacteria inside will begin to decay the body, and they release gases as they do this. So various parts of the body, including the belly, will start to bloat. They'll blow up like a balloon because of the gas. And people are thinking, they just had a blood meal. They're full. You know, they just ate something. Why would the stomach be
swollen? Yeah, and it may make sounds, right? Because that gas has to get out.
That brings me to the final point.
Yeah.
So they figured, how can we stop these corpses from coming back and feeding on our blood? Well, let's pin them to the ground. So they would drive a stake through the chest. And just like you were assuming not long ago, sometimes that would push the gases in the decaying body up through the esophagus and out the mouth, and it would actually release a groan.
Through the vocal cords.
Yeah.
Which are still intact.
And that will kind of confirm, if you will, in a wrong way, that yes, this person's, you know, still coming back to life. And that's why we get the legend of driving the stake through the chest to keep vampires from feeding on us, because it pins them to the ground and they can no longer come back.
And that's interesting. And I would assume that when that gas gets released, then there's kind of almost a sighing sound as it ends, as the stake goes to its final resting place, which might give you this sense that I've killed it.
That's right.
For sure.
It's finally dead.
Oh, that is really, you know, what I love about this is where a historical look back at some of what's really happening informs how we might understand how things become myth and legend in what we're doing. When you work on the other side, Ben, with playwriting, which is what you do in script writing, I've heard it said that sometimes that even when we think about worst case scenarios in the future for military or other things, that we like to go to playwrights who write science fiction, because sometimes they have a way of seeing things and viewing things different. So what does a playwright have that makes them a little different?
Well, I guess, you know, again, if you're writing a play or you're trying to tell a story, it doesn't necessarily rest on the science or the technology or, you know, the possibilities. That's a huge part of it. But what you have to start with are central characters who want something. And that is what's going to take them through the story, this unending desire. And they have to get it. And so that's when you can get really cool characters who either want something that's very selfless for other people or for society or civilization or their loved ones. Or you might, on the opposite end, have someone who wants to destroy all of those things. And so when you come at it from a personal standpoint like that, then that's when you can really see not only the possibilities of, you know, a scientific reality we don't know, maybe like an apocalypse, but also where it's coming from and how it could happen. If you relate it back to, how is this possible? Well, if this person wanted this and this person wanted that, then before you know it, you have kind of, you know, a reality that resembles an apocalypse.
Wow. And where's the line here between what I would call the idea of horror and the idea of science fiction? Are they blended, or I know in movies they're sort of separate genres. What do you think's happening in there?
For me personally, when I think of horror, I think of, again, something that wants to get you, whether it's a blob or you know a big fish or someone who's come back from the dead or a really handsome teenage vampire. But when it's science fiction, it could be anything that separates us from our daily reality, that I fly to work in my hoverboard as opposed to taking my car. That alone can make it science fiction. Or, you know, if you go back to 1870, the idea that, you know, somebody could take a submarine that runs on electricity and go all the way around the world that way, which was unbelievable then, but then became a reality.
Yeah, and I think there's some element in there that it could be more believable. Sometimes I always like in my own mind to think of horror as being something that's so far-fetching, I mean, way out there, that it's hard to even imagine it's real. Mm-hmm. Although you would, Bill, you were just talking in a way that would make sense that it would be, you could see horror as being science fiction almost.
Well, there's certainly areas where there's a Venn diagram and they cross.
Yeah.
I mean, Alien would be the classic.
Yeah.
You know, someone's for after sure. you, but it's on another planet, another spaceship. So there can be a combination of them. But we have a lot of horrors right here on Earth that still exist, you know, but we know better that they're probably not driven by any sort of supernatural force. More likely it's an infection or a genetic condition. There's some natural explanation for the horror that we see.
So I like to think we were talking about the House of Blue Lights. When I was a kid, I would drive up that driveway. And, you know, you're supposed to drive up there, and what was supposed to happen was the power would go out in your car. And, you know, there'd be some sort of supernatural feeling that was around you, and you get really scared. And I remember driving up there, and nothing happened. But when I came back, I didn't want to say nothing happened. So I created what did happen as to have kind of like a street cred. How much do you think that happens for people where they don't, that it's obvious that something's in front of them, but they don't want it, like the Emperor's New Clothes? How much do we need to do that?
Yeah, I think, I think that's what, again, the kind of oral tradition of sitting around the fire and telling stories. It's enjoyable to feel like it's something real. And again, if our imaginations are always plugging away, then not only do we want to be a part of the existing story, but maybe add to it. And if you do that over time, and then, you know, the story keeps growing and growing.
Wow. So this strange but true stuff where we get, like we were beginning in the last episode talking about the idea of what happens to cats, it's interesting to me because I think we have this universal kind of creeping out about bugs, whether they're microscopic or whether they're the other. And what is that? What do you think that's playing into to make us so scared of that?
It probably goes back to infection. Grooming behavior is seen in primates and probably has originated millions of years ago. So it's a very ancient behavior, and it's actually one that's thought to have brought about this wonderful quality of altruism that we share.
Mm-hmm.
But it all had its origins in trying to keep one another clean and in trying to keep our loved ones and friends free of disease.
Yeah, and so that made, we had a kind of an inherent aversion to a bug.
Yes, I think that's exactly where it goes to, because it probably doesn't, I don't think it's any great leap of the imagination to associate with, you know, contamination, bugs, you know, horrible smells, and pustulating skin with some sort of, you know, they didn't call it infection at the time, but they knew it could happen to them. So they wanted to minimize that as much as possible.
Wow. Yeah, I finished not too long ago, which I'd suggest to listeners to do, but a book that was talked a little bit about the whole idea of where cholera came from and how long it took for people to not believe it was the foul smell stuff that they had around them, but it was actually waterborne. And it took a long, long time for that to happen. So I think that's interesting. We really kind of hone in on certain things that are disgusting to us.
Well, maybe we became desensitized to it because that was the life that people knew, understood, and accepted. And as you know, if you walk into a room and smell something funny, your nose usually adjusts to it within a matter of minutes. So I think even though we would view that lifestyle where people were just dumping filth into the streets as repulsive and how could you live like that, if it was the norm, you probably got used to it, as disgusting as that sounds to us. Yeah. So it was a dogma at the time. It was entrenched in their minds that this was normal. There's nothing unusual about it. And it was hard to accept the idea that water could be making us so sick.
Wow. So, Ben, sometimes we hold people, and we use that in the theater arts, to hold people in a little bit of suspense. Yeah, Bill, you talked about it being we need a little mystery. We need to be in there, and you were talking about what do you think about the idea of that suspense? Is that a common part of theater?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, a story has to be built, and it built in such a way that it unfolds as you move, and not only unfolds, but the stakes grow as you move forward, and that, you know, especially if you're talking about a play, that one scene should not only, you know, give the information about the character and the plot to the audience, but also set up the next one, the following scene. And that's why I think we keep coming back to stories. We want to know what's going to happen next. And, you know, and also what the higher cost is going to be in the next scene or the next chapter or something like that.
So this is why we binge on Netflix. They always leave us with a cliffhanger.
They do.
Our mind can't stand it. It wants that closure, so we jump right in and watch the next episode.
Right.
Yeah. And they've made an art form of making binge watching possible.
That's right.
Which is really true.
And usually, especially when we're talking about things that are spooky and horror or science fiction, is that it's the most fun when the central character that you're rooting for is completely outmatched, like you know, Sigourney Weaver against a massive alien that bleeds acid. She is horribly outmatched. But again, the humans, and we all relate to this, have ingenuity and we're resourceful and smart and we can count on each other. And so even though we're the underdogs in horror and science fiction, the good ending you usually see is that we come out on top because of our big brains.
Yeah, you know, aliens, I remember when I first saw the first episode, they never really showed you much of it. It was just the creepy things it left behind. And I was thinking about cicadas, you know. So we had the 17-year-old locusts, which really are the black cicadas that come out when my children were young living in Chicago. It was about as creepy as you get. There were the creepiest thing were these shells everywhere that were kind of alien, like exoskeletons left behind. So I can imagine that there would be stories told about why that was such a bad event or what was happening.
Yeah, I would imagine the same. That's pretty creepy to come upon a shell. It just fuels the imagination as to what was that thing like when it was alive.
Right, or skin,
what,
you know.
What can it do to me?
Yeah, or skin left behind of a snake.
Yeah, how big is it now?
Yeah, that it had to. It never seemed to help when my parents said it needed to outgrow it to get bigger. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, well, what happened there? Well, this has been really great. I appreciate both of you for spending time with us talking about some spooky science. And I've been talking to Bill Sullivan. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And I've been at Harris. Thank you. And we're looking forward to seeing Thomas Say somewhere at a farmer's market when they come back again near you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Great. In our next segment, we'll be talking to our weekly Earth Charter Echo reporter. So stay tuned as She Says Art and He Says Science continues.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, journalist and arts and culture enthusiast.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. And we are the hosts of a new program on WICR called
She Says Art
and He Says Science.
Each week, we use art to teach science and bring you an hour of edutainment as we learn about the creative interaction between artist and scientist. Join us Saturday afternoons at 1 for She Says Art
and He Says Science.
Have You Heard airs every Wednesday at 9 p.m. right here on WICR 88.7. Have You Heard is a jazz radio show hosted by Matthew Altizer and Richard Dole, where we interview some of our favorite musicians and play some of our favorite music. Tune in every Wednesday at 9 p.m. or stream us live at WICROnline.org and discover some new music you didn't know you loved.
The Score is a weekly celebration of the music that makes good movies great. Host Edmund Stone covers all the bases with such topics as playing politics, summer blockbusters, The Orchestrator, Stranded, and features on individual composers for the cinema. It's a cultural trip through everyone's most common musical experience. That's The Score with Edmund Stone, Saturday mornings at 10 on WICR, a different kind of public radio.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back to She Says Art and He Says Science. I'm Mark Kiesling. If you do have a question, you can call us at 317-788-3314. Now it's time for our weekly report from one of the Earth Charter Equal reporters. And today we have joining us by phone Ella Comfort Barnett at Youth Power Indiana. And we want you to update us about your zero waste product. What else are you working on, Ella?
Well, my friend Sophie and I are working to reduce the waste in our cafeteria by food rescue and recycling, and we've reduced it by 75% so far since about a year ago.
Wow. Ella, you probably didn't get to hear part of what our show, but I've got Ben still here in the studio with me, and we were talking about the power of telling a story. How much do you need to tell a story to get across the ideas that you have?
Well, people listen more if you have a personal story versus just a list of facts or statistics. It really hits them deeper if you tell a story about why you're passionate versus telling them the facts about why you're passionate.
Yeah, so Ella, have you found in your experience trying to tell a story to somebody really makes a connection, a deeper connection?
Definitely.
That's great. What else are you working on now besides your Zero Waste Project?
Well, the Zero Waste Project takes up a lot of my time and Sophie's. We put all our effort into it. But I also just try and get my voice out there in terms of, well, I work on the Thrive Indianapolis Steering Committee for Indianapolis.
Yeah, on Thrive?
Yeah. And I do a few presentations about Thrive and the Climate Recovery Resolution.
Wow. You got an example of a story you could tell us that you tell people as a part of that?
As for why I'm passionate just about the environment in general?
Yes, please.
Well, I've seen the disasters, like what the changing climate has done. My god sister has asthma, and my mom does too, as well as a few of my friends. And it really hits me deep when I see them having problems with asthma, and I know that that's because of air pollution.
Yeah, that must really tug on things. It's hard for me to get people to understand I have asthma, and even when I walk around outside on a campus and somebody's smoking, it bothers me. And I think people don't even think about that. They don't think that people who have trouble breathing, which there's an increase in. Are you seeing from the things you're learning that there's an increase in asthma?
Yeah, I helped Mom clean Air Force. In this past summer, we went to D.C. to talk with our congressional representatives, and they had some statistics about asthma and lung problems. I've had a pneumonia twice, so I understand that.
Well, that's really, I guess, and this thing with stories, Ben, is really useful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
And I wanted to, you know, thank you for the good work you're doing, and also for taking that approach. You know, it's personal to you, but also people can see that because of your efforts, then they themselves or the people they know can be helped by a cleaner environment.
Yeah.
That's great. Ella, thank you for joining us. When we come back, it's going to be your chance to win prizes by answering a question about things you thought you knew when She Says Art and He Says Science continues.
This is Rockin' Dave, inviting you to join me every Sunday at midnight for Rockin' Dave's Roots Roundup, an hour of the best rockabilly, jump blues, and western swing. That's Rockin' Dave's Roots Roundup, every Sunday at midnight on WICR The Diamond. Get your roots on!
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
4, 3, 2, 1. Hi, I'm Joe Bainline. If you miss the rains down in Africa or think the one who has Betty Davis's eyes is a spaz, you should follow me on Twitter at RadioABFTP. If you like songs from the 80s and early 90s, you should listen to A Blast from the Past, Saturday evenings at 10, right here on WICR. It's your weekly public radio look back to a time when songs were sappy, movies were cheesy, and clothes were colorful. A Blast from the Past, Saturday night at 10, 88.7 WICR.
Listen every weekday at noon for Smooth Jazz with Doug Housemeyer, where you can find out what's happening in the arts community from the people in the arts community. You'll get smooth jazz legends like Pat Metheny, Dave Cause, and Boney James. Smooth Jazz with Doug Housemeyer on 88.7 The Diamond.
Welcome back. It's now your chance to win a prize by answering a question about things I thought you knew. I'm Mark Kiesling, and I have Ben with me in the studio. And Ben, I asked last week a question: as people become more concerned about the effects of global climate change on the oceans, they often look to increase of water as a result of melting. So people are worried and concerned about, you know, the ocean and sea rise. But there's actually a more serious problem. Do you know what that might be? Rather than the sea rise.
I thought it was the fact that it would change currents, which would then affect temperatures. Yeah.
That is part of it. The one that we're most worried about is that the oceans hold on to carbon dioxide. And they hold it, but as they warm, for every degree they warm, they're releasing that carbon dioxide, which compounds the global warming problem.
Yep.
And so people forget that release of carbon dioxide is actually the more compounding problem.
Right. It puts extra effort on
extra weight on it. So this week's question will be: in the early 1800s, Scottish surgeon James Braid made history by combining the emerging field of hypnosis with phrenology. And apparently Braid would put the patient in a trance and then examine the bumps on his head, which he correlated to the basis for emotions that the patient was feeling. And what problem in science is a treatment such as this related to? And do you know of any present day examples of this? If you know the answer, send us an email to WICR@thedaVinciPursuit.com. The winner will get a prize. And we invite you to visit the DaVinciPursuit.com website to see pictures of these projects we have discussed on He Says Art and She Says Science, and to see a selection of original art created by scientists. It's on our line, Science Art Gallery and Gift Shop. Ben, you know, this has been really great to have the time to look at spooky science, but through the lens of the characters you do. I know you've got some characters you're working on upcoming, so can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, absolutely. So along with Thomas Say, we want to bring these real people who made an impact on history out to the public, doing outreach performance. And again, we want to keep an emphasis on history and science. So a couple of the other ones we have are Gene Stratton Porter, who was a naturalist and an author. And she lived around kind of the Limberlost area in northern Indiana and was way ahead of her time as far as conservation. So she, you know, thought that taking photographs as opposed to getting live specimens and then killing them, whether they be moths or butterflies or birds, she was totally against that. She wanted to be the least bit invasive into natural regions as they were being kind of drained for getting to the oil beneath.
Oh, my goodness.
So she's a great one. And also Elwood Haynes, who in the 1890s developed one of the first cars and then probably did one of the first road tests ever done in the United States in Kokomo, Indiana.
Really?
So he was taking this useless byproduct. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. Gasoline, which was a byproduct of oil, which
really?
Nobody could find a use for. But he, you know, bought an engine that ran on this and was able to develop a horseless carriage. And again, you know, this is the mid-1890s. People thought he was nuts. And little did they know that would change everything.
That would change everything.
Yeah.
That is amazing. And that a woman was at the center of that, right? In driving the car, or the first woman to drive the car?
Oh, as far as
Ella?
Or oh, no, Elwood Haynes.
Elwood. Oh, it's Elwood. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. I was going to attribute to a woman more.
Although he and his wife would go on drives in Pioneer horseless carriage, which went about 7 miles in an hour. So, you know, pretty speedy, you know, Sunday drives that they would take.
So was that faster pretty much than a horse?
Well,
if I'm
not mistaken, the first car he built was about a 1 horsepower car, so about the same. But of course, you didn't have to feed it all the time. It didn't get sick. If one of the wheels broke, you could simply replace it. And so he really turned transportation on its head with that, and changed really you know, the world as we know it. And went against, you know, again, it needed more oil production. So as he is, you know, taking transportation to the future with internal combustion engines, here's Gene Stratton Porter trying to go the other way and preserve natural regions, especially swamps, which people thought were useless.
Right.
Why keep a swamp around? Well, the reason is because it's home to thousands of amazing creatures, you know, both plant and animal. And she was ahead of her time to know that. And she would write these novels as a way to get people into the swamp to see the wildlife. So she would add romance and adventure, but all the while being very specific about the birds and the plants and the insects that you would see in the Limberlost swamp.
So using story.
Yeah, exactly,
right?
Exactly.
What we've been talking about,
right,
was what her gift was,
so,
in that.
Pretty brilliant, yeah.
Wow, that is really brilliant. And at the same time, you know, we've had other women scientists who have been able to be great communicators.
Right.
Along the way.
And all the while, you know, people telling her, well, why are you wasting your time with this? This is what men are supposed to do. So you can imagine the pressure that she was under.
That is so great.
Yeah.
I want to thank our guests, Bill, Ben, and Ella. If you know any of the answers to our Things I Thought You Knew question, please email it to WICR@thedaVinciPursuit.com. Then again next week, tune in with us for more art and science conversations. But until then, please stay curious.
Thank you for listening to She Says Art and He Says Science. You can listen to the full show podcast on WICRonline.org, as well as on thedaVinciPursuit.com. Or you could join Jill Dittmeyer and Mark Kiesling every Saturday live on a different kind of public radio, 88.7 WICR.
Violinist Izzo Brizelli and composer Samuel Barber were both alumni of the Curtis Institute, but Brizelli was not pleased with what Barber wrote for him on a commission from a wealthy industrialist.